Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. At 72, Graham Nash remains part of rock royalty, a musician who came to the U.S. as part of the British invasion with his band The Hollies and plays on today with his supergroup Crosby, Stills, and Nash. In his career, he has stood alongside John, Paul, George, and Ringo, The Stones, Hendrix, Joni Mitchell, Rita Coolidge, and virtually the entire cast of characters who came to define rock and roll of the 60s and 70s. Along the way, he's written songs that became the landscape for a generation, Our House, Teach Your Children, and this one, Marrakesh Express.
Looking at the world through the sunset in your eyes, traveling the train through clear Moroccan skies. Ducks and pigs and chickens call, animal carpet wall to wall, American ladies 5 foot tall. Cobwebs from the edges of my mind. Had to get away to see what we could find. Hope the days that lie ahead bring us back to where they've led. Listen not to what's been said to you.
Graham Nash is a two-time Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee. He has a new autobiography out, Wild Tales, that chronicles a rock and roll life. Graham Nash is in town today, not to sing, but to give the keynote address at the 26th Annual Folk Alliance Conference and Winter Music Camp at Crown Center. And Graham Nash, what a pleasure to have you to join us this morning. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Steve. How are you today?
Well, I'm great. And let's begin with that song, because there's a great story behind that song that you tell in the book. Where did that song come from, Graham?
I went to Morocco to follow the footsteps of William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg and the rest of the beat poets.
Of course.
They were there in Morocco smoking dope and writing poetry. It sounded good to me. So in 1966, I went to Morocco for a month and took the train, obviously, from Casablanca down to Marrakesh. And I had, you know, it was pretty cheap, so I had first-class seats. But there was nothing going on in the first-class compartment.
Yes.
It was completely boring.
So you got up and moved.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I moved back to the third class, and that was where the action was happening. People lighting fires and cooking and with goats and pigs and sheep. It was a much better experience than the first-class compartment.
You talk about how Stephen Stills put some touches on that song, including what's that instrument that sort of floats above the melody so often throughout that song?
That's Stephen Stills on electric guitar, double tracked.
Ah, okay.
He played it. He played the first track and then harmonized with the second track, and that's what that sound is.
It sounds a little bit like a sitar. That whole idea, right?
Yes, indeed. We wanted to make it a little less. English, as you might.
God forbid.
Well, he did the same with my song Teach Your Children. When I first played Stephen Teach Your Children, I almost sang it like Henry VIII. And Stephen looked at me and he said, you know, that's a really good song. Don't ever play it like that again. This is how it should go. And he put that kind of country feel to it that made it such a big record.
You know, you talk so often in this book about all the contributions each of you made, but Stephen Stills being, in your words, I think, a musical genius, Graham.
Yes, I believe so. I mean, listen to those early songs of his. They're brilliant. Everything from Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, which was put together from four different songs that Stephen had written and not finished, but he decided that one day he would put them all together into what became Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. And songs like 4 and 20, which is one of the saddest, loneliest songs I've ever heard.
Who had the idea at the end of Sweet Judy Blue Eyes to do the da 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 da? Whose idea was that?
It's all Stephen.
Yeah, yeah. What a neat contribution. Yeah,
well, really. I mean, the man is really a musical genius.
Well, let's begin at the beginning for Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Graham, because you tell this story again in the book. The first time the three of you sang together, you're at Joni Mitchell's house one day, and Stephen Stills and David Crosby are inside. You walk up to the house, and you see that other people are there, and that sort of made you a little hesitant to go inside. Did you almost walk away at that point?
No, I'd come several thousand miles from London to Los Angeles. There was no way I was going to walk away from anything. But my point is that I was there to be with Joan.
Mm-hmm. And Joni Mitchell, yeah.
Yeah, yes. And when I realized that there were other people there, I did hesitate a little, just, you know, how do I handle this, you know, But I knew that it was David and Stephen, because I'd called Joni from the airport to tell her that I was in town and heading over to see her. And that was the very first time that we ever sang together.
It was the first time you sang together, but you knew each other at that point, right?
Yes, kind of. Not because I was English and from I was living in London at the time, and they were, of course, Californian. We didn't meet up a lot, but I certainly knew David and Stephen, yes.
So you go inside, and David and Stephen had been working on a song together. The song is You Don't Have to Cry. What happened next?
They sang it. I got to the end of the song with them, and I said, you know, Stephen, first of all, that's an incredible song, which it is, of course. That was on the first Crosby, Stills and Nash record. So I asked them to sing it again. And they looked at each other and they kind of shrugged, and they sang it for the second time. And then I asked them to have a little patience and just sing it one more time. Mm-hmm. And by the third time that they sang it, I had my harmony down. And as I say in Wild Tales, whatever sound vocally that Crosby, Stills and Nash has was born within 40 seconds.
It happened instantly. I mean, Graham, that's not fair.
I know. But, you know, the world's not fair.
What was the reaction in the room at that moment when you guys began to harmonize on You Don't Have to Cry?
Well, there was only one other person there, and that was Joni. And, of course, you know, being as brilliant as she is, and you know, my own personal opinion is that she is by far a much better songwriter than all of us put together. She obviously could hear. She has a great set of ears, of course. She's a brilliant musician and was smiling all the way through it. I wish Cass would have been there, Cass Elliott from the mm-hmm. Mamas and Papas, because she was the first person to introduce me to David, who then introduced me to Stephen. I wish she could have been there for the very first time that we ever sang together. And this is one of the things that is so strange about life, is that we all have our own truths. You know, Stephen is convinced to this day that the very first time we ever sang together was in Cass's kitchen, and it's just not right, you know.
Did you know, Graham, at that moment when you guys began singing together, did you think, you're with the Hollies at that point, it's a, you know, super group, an amazingly successful group, but did you know that there was something going on there that you had to pursue with Crosby and Stills?
Halfway through the song, we had to actually stop and start laughing. It was so ridiculously good. And at that moment, I knew that I would have to leave the Hollies, I would have to leave my country and all my bank account and everything, and come and follow this, what I likened to a golden sound that I'd heard. When David and Stephen and I sing together, nobody has any claim on the notes that we sing, but I don't think anybody in the world sounds like we do. Mm-hmm. And I knew from that moment that my life had changed dramatically, and that I would have to spend several years with these guys, these two crazy people. And, you know, that was 45 years ago.
Well, what an amazing story. Let's listen to that first song that, again, is on the first Crosby, Stills, and Nash album. Again, the track, You Don't Have to Cry.
In the morning when you rise, do you think of me and how you left me crying? Are you and managers, and where you got to be at noon? You are living a reality. I left years ago, it quite nearly killed me. In the long run, it will make you cry, make you crazy, old before your time. And the difference between me and you, I won't argue right or wrong, but I have time to cry, my baby. You don't have to cry. I said cry, my baby. You don't have to cry. I said cry, my baby. You don't have to cry.
No, know, Graham, that was beautiful 45 years ago, and it's just marvelous today. What a great song.
Yes. We've been doing it recently also. We've been singing that first album live on stage. We did it first at the Beacon Theatre in New York about a year ago, and then at the Albert Hall in London. And it's fun doing those songs one after another like that in the order that we put them in.
You know, as you work through that first album, did the three of you have to rehearse and practice to sort of match the what you accomplished in that first song there, or did it just come naturally track after track?
I think the process is that whoever writes the song usually takes the melody.
Yeah.
And then David and I, if Stephen wrote the song, figure out where we're going to go. If David's going to go under Stephen and I'm going to go on top of both of them, or vice versa. And we very often switch parts, often within the same song. Rehearse, yes. It's almost like... when Phil Everly passed away just recently, I began to really wonder what made their sound so brilliant. And I came up with the fact that they're genetically linked. They were brothers. They've been hearing themselves ever since they were young kids. They were on the radio with their dad on his radio show. David and Stephen and I are not obviously genetically linked, but we have to start every phrase at the exact same moment. So we're constantly checking each other's breathing patterns and body language. And we did a certain amount of rehearsing, too. We were able to take a couple of acoustic guitars and play that first record for our friends in their living rooms and literally blow people away. I mean, when you hear that first album with just a couple of acoustic guitars, I mean, it was stunning to a lot of our friends.
Can you match that sound today? Do you have to rehearse now after 45 years, Graham, or does it come, are you guys just in sync after this many years?
I think the older we get and the more mature we get, the better we get. Do we have that same kind of young, fresh sound? I don't think so, but we still sound very, very good together. I wouldn't do it if we couldn't, you know, touch people's hearts. I just wouldn't be interested. But so far, and as you know, it's been many, many years, we keep writing songs that touch people. We have a great job. I mean, first of all, we're musicians. We get to play on stage. We get to play music. We get to touch people's hearts. We get to, you know, maybe to have them think differently about their fellow human being and about themselves. And we get, you know, some political stuff off our chests, and romantic stuff off our chests, and we get paid mightily for it. And then at the end, the audience leaves with a smile on their face. What a job.
Not a bad deal, eh?
No, not a bad deal at all.
When the three of you start your American concert tour next month, do you have to rehearse together much, or again, can you pick it up pretty quickly and just run with it?
Part of the difficult part about going on tour is because we have so many songs, because we've always been constantly writing for the last four decades, the delicate dance is the choosing of the songs that we do. Here's one of the problems. We understand why people are coming to see us. We understand that they love certain songs. They want to hear The Sweet. They want to hear Teach Your Children. They want to hear Guinevere, etc. Yeah. And we know that, and we feel a certain responsibility to do that. Having said that, we need to keep it fresh for ourselves. So we change key, we change arrangements subtly, but to keep ourselves alive so that we're not just, you know, spewing it out at, you know, by rote. At the same time, our audience really understands that they may hear a song that was written this morning.
Yeah.
And they certainly don't demand it, but they expect it. And of course, those are the songs that we have to rehearse. We don't have to rehearse Wooden Ships. We don't have to rehearse Long Time Gone. We don't have to rehearse Military Madness. We don't have to rehearse, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We know all those. I mean, we'll go through them a couple of times to make sure we've got the endings right, et cetera, et cetera. But it's the new stuff that we have to rehearse.
We're visiting with Graham Nash of Crosby, Stills & Nash. So how long after the three of you were in Joni's house that day did Crosby, Stills & Nash formally get together, Graham?
Intellectually, that moment.
Yeah.
Live on stage, Crosby, Stills & Nash did not appear live on stage as Crosby, Stills & Nash until 1977. All those early years were with Neil.
Mm-hmm.
So it was Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young at Woodstock, at the Greek Theater, and et cetera, until 1977, when actually CSN alone went out for the first time.
Woodstock. Tell me about that day.
Crazy, thrilling, wet, muddy, shouldn't have happened. Flying over, it was like flying over an encampment of the Macedonian army. Fires. People loving each other, people getting on together, you know, close to 500,000 people and no violence. Quite inadequate sound reinforcement in terms of monitors. But I recently saw Sweet Judy Blue Eyes that we did at Woodstock, and it was shocking to me how good it actually was. Because you would take a guitar that was tuned in a tent by the side of the stage, at a certain temperature, you would take it out on stage and it would obviously change tuning because of the temperature difference between the tent and the stage. So in the footage of us doing Sweet Judy Blue Eyes at Woodstock, you can actually see Stephen tuning in the middle of the song and not batting an eyelid. And it was Stephen that said that we were scared pretty good.
Were you scared?
No, not at all.
Really?
No, not at all. Why?
All
I'd already
people.
Been through it for 7 years with the Hollies.
Yeah, I guess.
You know, all that screaming and mass adulation from huge audiences was nothing to me. I'd been through it all before, so I wasn't scared at all at Woodstock. No.
I know you're asked this question a lot, but I just got to ask it. Do you have a favorite CSN song or CSNY song? Is there one that to this day it stands out for you?
Yes, there's several. Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, of course, brilliant song, and Ohio by CSNY. I've just, we're mastering today, as a matter of fact, the box set that I've just put together with my fellow producer Joel Bernstein and my great engineer Stanley Johnston. Three CDs, a DVD of 8 videos that were shot in 1974. This is our 1974 stadium tour album.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've just spent the last couple of years putting it all together. And I must tell you that I fell back in love with who David and Stephen and Neil were. And I must say, you know, and I'm not a man to brag much, but we were a very, very good band.
You know, Graham, you mentioned Ohio, the song Ohio, written, of course, as a tribute to those who were killed at Kent State. You talk about that song in Wild Tales and how quickly you put that song out and what you had to give up to get that song out and receive radio play. Tell us that story.
David and Neil were in a house that of a friend of ours in Pescadero in Northern California for a weekend, just getting away from the madness. David had a copy of a magazine that had the John Philo photograph of the girl bending over the slain body of one of the students at Kent State. David said that Neil looked at it, read the article, took his guitar, walked out into the woods, and came back an hour later with this song. I was in Los Angeles with Stephen. David called me. He said, book the studio right now. Book the band, book the engineer, get the tape together, we're coming down. And I said, wow, you sound intense, what's going on? He said, wait until you hear this song that Neil Young just wrote. They came down, we recorded it the next night. We recorded the B-side, Find the Cost of Freedom, in about an hour. The whole session for Ohio and Find the Cost of Freedom only took about 4 hours. Our friend and the owner of Atlantic Records, our dear friend Ahmet Erdogan, who was one of the greatest musical minds of his generation, was there at the studio. We mixed it. We gave it to Ahmet, and we said, we want it out now. Ahmet looked at us and he said, wait a second, you have Teacher Children in the top 20. It's going up into the top 10. It might even be a number one record. We said, we don't care. This is way more important because when America starts killing its children, it's in deep trouble. And we need this record out now. And we actually put that record out within 2 weeks.
Boy, that's a great story. But you got it out in 2 weeks at a time when that just never happened, right?
No. But that's how much Ahmet believed in us and what we were trying to do. He knew that the songs that we write are to us important. They have a reason for existing. They have a reason for living. I don't want to waste your time, Steve. I won't play you a song that I feel, you know, would be wasting your time. I mean, it's the only thing that we have, right? We have time and we have our family and we have our friends. What else is there? So, we put it out as soon as we got it. And the mock-up for the 45 sleeve actually had a picture of the Constitution of the United States with four bullet holes in it.
This is Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. You know, the forerunners of all this, and you've already mentioned it, Graham, were the Everly Brothers. I mean, they were heroes of yours. How much of an impact did they have on the way you looked at music and the kind of music that you yourself eventually wanted to make?
Not only were the Everly Brothers important to me musically, because when I was 15 years old, I first heard Bye Bye Love by the Everly Brothers, and it stopped me in my tracks, and I've always wanted to make music that made people feel the way I felt when I first heard that.
You heard Bye Bye Love at a school dance, right?
That's right, a Saturday night Catholic girls' school, yes. Alan and I walked downstairs and gave the young lady our tickets, and we saw a girlfriend of ours across the ballroom floor, and we're halfway across the floor after, I think, You Send Me by Sam Cooke had just finished playing, and that was the one where, you know, it was a touchy-feely slow dance, you know, and, you know, because of, you know, everyone was trying to figure out what sex was at that point in their lives.
Sure.
It was very important, and the lights were low, of course, but then the lights came up and they cleared the floor and we went across the ballroom floor, and that's when they played Bye Bye Love, and it changed my life. But more importantly, Don and Phil taught me that if your heroes look you in the eye and really make contact with you, it's phenomenally important. When Alan and I, on April 22nd, 1960, the Everly Brothers played in Manchester at the Free Trade Hall, which is roughly where I come from. Mm-hmm. I come from Salford, which is a suburb of Manchester, but the Free Trade Hall is in Manchester City itself. And we not only did we decide that we were going to go watch the concert, but we were determined to try and meet them. When we got to the concert, we looked around. There were no tour buses. So it wasn't like they were going to pack up after the show in Manchester and drive to Newcastle, because there was no bus. So we figured that they were going to stay at the hotel. Now then, only about 100 yards from the Free Trade Hall is the Midland Hotel, one of the finest hotels in Manchester at the time. And so we figured that's where they were staying. So we waited after the concert, and we waited and we waited and we waited, and it's pouring down, and we know that we've missed the last bus home, and we're going to have to walk 9-10 miles home. But we didn't care. The Everly Brothers came around the corner, and instead of just patting us on the head and signing an autograph, they actually stood and talked to me and Alan Clark and called us by our names, asking us what we were doing. And we told them, like, we sing some of your songs, and we want to make records when we were older. You know, I mean, we were in 1960, I was 18 years old. So they made contact with me, and that was incredibly important for me, because it showed me how to deal with people. And when I, you know, when I became, you know, well known and was admired by certain people, and they come up and talk to me, I want them to know that they actually made contact with me rather than just be shuffled aside. So not only musically were the Everly Brothers important to me, but socially also.
And the good news is there's a sequel to this. Later, a few years later, you would actually spend some time with the Everly Brothers in a hotel room, and you actually spent time together talking. They took some songs that you had written, and tell us, you've had a relationship with them, I guess.
Yes. That first meeting was April 22nd, 1960, and in 1966...
You remember the date.
I do indeed.
Oh, that's great.
In 1966, the Hollies were playing at the London Palladium, and Pete Seeger was the headline act. After we did sound check, the phone rang backstage, and our roadie, Rod Shields, said, yes, yeah, he's right here, hold on. And he hands me the phone, and I go, who is it? He goes, it's Phil Everly. I said, are you kidding me? So I pick up the phone and I go, hello? He goes, hey, Graham, it's Phil. Me and Don are in town and we want to know if the Hollies have got any songs that they haven't recorded. And we were full of piss and vinegar at that time and we had lots of songs. So we went to the hotel where they were staying in London and we played them a bunch of songs. And the next day we started recording an album with them that they called Two Yanks in England. And so, you know, from being 15 years old and hearing the Everly Brothers and having it change my life to meeting them in 1960 and having them change my life and then recording with them in 1966. Let me add one more thing.
Yeah.
In 1992, I was in Toledo, Ohio, and CSM was playing at a certain place. And the phone rings in my hotel room, which was unusual. I answered it, and it was Phil again. And he said, I said, I'm in Toledo, Ohio. What's going on? Why are you calling me here? He goes, because we're here in town, because we're playing tonight, the same place you're going to play tomorrow. So do you want to come down to our concert? And of course I do. So me and my best friend, Mac Holbert, went down on the Everly Brothers bus to the place that they were playing. And after sound check, Don looks at me and he goes, so what are you going to sing with us? Now I'm dying.
Yes.
I'm dying
yes.
inside. I'm trying to be so cool, but I'm dying inside. This was a lifelong dream for me. So I said, yeah, so sad. I like that song, So Sad. And Don goes like this. And we did like 2 minutes and he said, yeah. And so Phil looks at me and he goes, you know, I'll go underneath Don. You take my part. And I said to Phil, why? He said, well, I've got the high part. I mean, you're not going to be able to sing above me. And I said, Phil, you taught me to sing high. That was you that I was following. You stay where you are. I have a board tape, a cassette of me singing So Sad in three part with the Everly Brothers that thrills me to this day.
That's a great story. That's a great story. Let's do this. We'll take a break in just a moment. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with Graham Nash of Crosby, Stills & Nash. His new book, his new autobiography, Wild Tales. He'll be signing copies of his book this evening at 6 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call Rainy Day Books in Fairway at 913-384-3126 or visit kcur.org for more details. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.
It's getting to the point where I'm no fun anymore.
I am sorry.
Sometimes it hurts so badly I must cry out loud.
I am lonely.
I am yours. You are mine. You are what you are.
You make it hard.
Remember what we've said and done and felt about each other.
Oh, babe, have mercy.
Don't let the past remind us of what we are not now.
I am not dreaming.
I am yours. You are mine. You are what you are.
You make it hard. Tearing yourself away from me now, you are free, and
I am crying. This does not mean I don't love you. I do, that's forever. Yes, and for always.
I am yours, you are mine. You are what you are. You make it hard.
Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We're visiting today with Graham Nash of Crosby, Stills & Nash, his new book, Wild Tales. Now, this notion, Graham, we were talking in our first half about harmony bands and the Everly Brothers and the influence they had on you. But this idea of a harmony band, there were so many of them around during the mid-60s that preceded Crosby, Stills & Nash. I'm thinking of the Hollies and the Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds. Why don't we hear as much of that today?
Well, I think you do. I think you with the Fleet Foxes and Mumford and Sons. I think you're here. I think one thing that we must understand, and this is probably one of the things I'm going to be talking about at the Folk Alliance.
Yeah.
Is that we're just a link in a long, huge chain of musicians that were traveling from town to town telling everybody that the emperor really doesn't have any clothes on. And I feel very proud to be a musician, and I feel very proud to have been in share this chain with the Weavers and Pete Seeger and Peter Paul and Mary and Phil Oakes and Bob Dylan and Woody Guthrie. And we're just part of this chain, and to see the chain continuing into the future is very exciting for me. There's one band that's going to be playing there. I think they're called Darlingside, I think, do a version of Woodstock that Joni wrote that I saw on YouTube recently, and it's brilliant.
You know,
so it all moves forward, you know.
Most kids, it seems to me, grow up wanting to be, you know, the star, the lead singer of the band. And yet you seem drawn all along to wanting and being comfortable with sharing that spotlight. Was that ever hard for you?
No, not at all. I just want to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the job is, let's get it done with the most fun time and the dignity and respect that we can. And I think in most part it's because I'm English. My country was almost bombed out of existence twice within 80 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you come from a background where you didn't really know whether your house was going to be there tomorrow or whether your friends would be alive, I think it it changes you drastically. I don't think that David or Stephen or Neil had anything like the same experiences that I had. I was born in 1942, and World War II didn't stop until 1945, of course. And so for those first 3 years, I remember the blackouts, which is where you would have to pull heavy, dark curtains across the living room window so that the light didn't shine through, so that the enemy bombers didn't know where to bomb. But when life is so fragile and so fleeting, as it was in my early days, it changes the way you think. I want to get the job done because tomorrow I might not be here.
There's a night I wanted to ask you about out of Wild Tales, and there are so many interesting stories in this book, but one you describe in your book really stuck with me. It's the morning of June 25th, 1967. The phone rings, and you're not happy because you're still waking up. On the other end of the line is who, Graham?
It was a Sunday morning. And I'd been up, you know, most of the night, as most musicians are. And so I didn't like getting woken up. But when I answered the phone, it was my friend Paul McCartney. He wanted to invite me and my friend Gary Leeds, who was the drummer with the Walker Brothers, who were a very famous band at the time. We were sharing an apartment. Wanted us to come down to Abbey Road, the EMI studios in London, to take part in a thing that they were doing that was going to be broadcast to maybe 400 million people. It was the first satellite broadcast. And John Lennon had written a song called All You Need Is Love for that broadcast. And to be invited was thrilling. To go and attend that was utterly thrilling. I mean, you know, there were a bunch of our friends, you know, everyone from Mick Jagger to Marianne Faithfull and to, you know, Eric Clapton, you know, lots and lots of our of our peers at there, sitting down, watching the Beatles do that live. And that was a tremendous moment for me. I mean, George Martin had written this brilliant string part for the song. They played part of the Marseillaise. They played In the Mood by, you know, little snippets of beautiful, beautiful, well-known songs at the end as the record fades. Yeah, a great moment for me. I'll never forget that.
Hey, how much reverence did you, Graham, and I guess everybody else for that matter, hold for the Beatles even in 1967 when they were still together?
I first saw the Beatles in November the 19th of 1959. They were Johnny and the Moondogs. We were playing a local talent show. And it was very obvious even then that they had something. They had this rough edge, this cheeky kind of humorous edge to everything that they did. It was very obvious that they were going to be famous. It was very obvious in hindsight that they're the world's greatest band. I don't think that anything ever like that will ever happen again. I walked into a music store quite recently, and you know, while I was paying the bill, there was one of those stands with magazines and books on it.
Yeah.
And I picked up one that said 100 Beatles songs. And I went to the back and I started to look at the list, and I got through the first 20 and I'm staggered. And I got through the first 50 and I didn't know what to do with myself. And I got to the end of the 100 songs and it was stunning to me just how great the Beatles actually were. They are, without question, the world's greatest rock and roll band.
So when you were around them, could you be yourself or were you shy? Was it awkward? What was that like for you?
No, we're from the north of England. We're not shy at all. You know, like I said, you know, Liverpool is only about 56 miles from Manchester. So we share a lot in common. They were bombed tremendously during World War II, as was Manchester, because both those cities are on the Manchester Ship Canal. That's where all the goods and services got to the north of England, through mainly through that canal. And the Germans, of course, were trying to bomb it, you know, to stop goods and services getting to the north. Consequently, people in Manchester are pretty tough. People in Liverpool, way tougher than the people in Manchester. Way, way tougher. I mean, if you put a word wrong in Liverpool, you'd get your face smacked and, you know, and get beat up. I mean, I'm not kidding. They were tough. And the Beatles were obviously born around the same time as I was and experienced the same things. And they were pretty tough guys. But we weren't shy with each other. I mean, why? Let's get on with this here.
Tell me about them, John Lennon, Paul McCartney. Describe them to me. You knew them in a way none of us ever will.
Well, Paul was very friendly. He was the diplomat of the group. There's no question about that. He was the one first with a smile, whereas John rarely smiled when he first met you. John was the kind of person that would keep you at arm's length before he would let you into his inner circle because he wasn't. He didn't trust people much. He was the roughhouse of the band. He was the joke player. He was the leader. I mean, it was really John's band in the very beginning. I just finished the book on the Beatles that was written by the same man that helped me with my book, Bob Spitz. He wrote a brilliant biography of the Beatles, and I just finished it. And I realized just how much my feelings about the boys actually was shared by many other people. So Paul was the diplomat, and John was the one that you had to look out for.
You once had a tiff with George Harrison. What was that about?
The Hollies recorded If I Needed Someone, which was a Beatles song and written by George. And I thought we did a pretty good job of it, but George didn't like it at the time and said so in the press. And it was, you know, it was upsetting to have the Beatles say that this song is rubbish. And I mean, the performance of this song by the Hollies is rubbish. You know, it just upset me. And I told him so too. Because at that point, you know, the truth is that if you didn't know John and Paul, George and Ringo, you weren't anybody, you know, and there was a kind of a cultural line that stretched across England from just north of Birmingham. And if you, you know, if you were south of Birmingham, you spoke the Queen or the King's English, and you were kind of posh. But anything north of Birmingham, and you were a peasant still, and that's where we came from. We were considered peasants. When the Beatles became very popular, of course, everybody south of Birmingham wanted to speak with a Liverpool accent. I mean, it was hysterically funny to all of us, you know, just how they broke down. It wasn't a racial thing. It was a societal line. But they opened up that door, and every band wanted to run through that door that they just created. It was an amazing time. The Summer of Love in England was a phenomenal time. Carnaby Street and new clothes and new ideas. And we're coming out. I mean, America was coming out of the Eisenhower administration, of course, and had Kennedy as president, which gave hope to a lot of young people. And then, of course, tragically, Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. And I think about 4 months later, the Beatles played on Ed Sullivan's show and continued that sense of hope and that sense that the past was over and there was a new way forward that looked very, very inviting.
Graham Nash is our guest. Graham Nash of Crosby, Stills & Nash. He gives a keynote address today at the 26th Annual Folk Alliance Conference and Winter Music Camp. You also talk in this book about Paul Simon and the influence he had on you. And it was interesting to me that he introduced you to an album, and it's not the album that I would have guessed in the first 750 tries at it, probably. But what was struck me as so interesting, because it was the music of Bulgaria, of all places. And, of course, world music would go on to greatly, you know, influence his music over the years. But what did you take away from his pick of the music of Bulgaria, Graham?
We were in the Holiday Inn in Manhattan, I think late 66, early 67, on a tour of America. And the doorman calls my hotel room and he says, there's somebody down here to meet you. And I said, who is he? He said, his name is Paul Simon. And we had recorded Paul's song, I Am a Rock, and did a pretty good version of it. And I think Paul really liked it. So he came to the hotel to meet me. He invited me to go with him and Arthur to the CBS studios and watch them record. And in the process of hanging out with him for a couple of days, I asked him what his favorite record was. And he said, it's this record, The Musical Bulgaria. And he had one in his briefcase, strangely enough. It's the greatest harmony record I've ever heard in my life. I've subsequently given away literally hundreds of that album to people that I think would really enjoy it. It's also one of Crosby's favorite albums, too. Unbelievable harmony records. In the early 90s, I got a call from Elektra Records, who had a deal to put out that record, Nonesuch, rather. And they asked me if I wanted to come to New York, because the ladies from the musical Bulgaria, from that choir of ladies that sang on that record, were coming to New York, and would I come to New York and introduce them to the press? So I jumped on that opportunity. It would to pay them back for giving me so much musical pleasure. So I did that. After the press event, the translator comes up to me and he goes, you know, the ladies would like to say something to you, Graham. So, and I'm expecting, thank you, Mr. Nash, for, you know, coming to New York to introduce us. And instead, they gathered around me.
Yeah.
One of them went, 1, 2, 3, 4. And in perfect multi-harmony, they sang, do-do-do-do-do, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. I swear to God, I have a photograph of that moment of me hearing them sing Sweet Judy Blue Eyes to me and realizing just how wide the ripples stretch when you drop a pebble into a lake.
That's a great story. That's a wonderful story. Joni Mitchell, you fell in love with her in 1967. I wonder if you describe that first day and maybe a little bit about that night, too, because you describe it in such vivid detail in Wild Tales, Graham. It's also a wonderful story.
The Hollies were playing in Ontario in Canada on a tour, and David had, he'd been my friend for about a year at that point, and he said that he had a friend, Joni Mitchell, and that she was a really great writer and a beautiful woman. And if I ever met her, tell her that, we're friends and I think everything will be okay. So after the show in Ontario, there were the Hollies were being thrown a party, you know, by the local promoter, and we're standing there with a glass of cheap wine in a plastic cup, you know, and you know, schmoozing with people that we don't know, and just to be polite, etc. And my manager, Robin Britton, starts coming up to me and he's talking in my ear about something, and I'm just not there, because in the corner of the room was a beautiful, beautiful woman, and she had like what looked like a large Bible on her lap. And so, being a musician and being a man who loves beautiful women, I was concentrating on trying to catch her eye or figuring out some way to introduce myself. And I said to Robin Britton, I said, "Stop talking in my ear. I'm trying to pick up on this woman here that's in the corner." He said, "Well, if you'll just listen, her name is Joni Mitchell, and she wants to meet you because, you know, she's friends with David Crosby." So I'm delighted, of course. So I go over and I introduce myself, and she knows who I am, of course, you know, not well, but she knew who I was. And she came to, she invited me to her hotel, which was at the Chateau Laurier, a beautiful old hotel in Ontario. And she played me maybe 15 of the greatest songs I'd ever heard at that point in my life. Michael from Mountains, I had a king, Nathan Lafreniere, unbelievable songs.
Just the two of you alone in the hotel room.
Yes, with a fire going and you know, beautiful colored scarves over the lamps to make everything cozy. I fell in love instantly. Not only was Joni an incredibly beautiful being, but she had these songs, and it was obvious to me that she was a genius, that I'd never heard songs like this in my life. And everything that David had told me about Joni was absolutely true. And I fell in love at that moment. And, you know, I love Joni to this day. I've been married to my wife, Susan, now for the last 37 years. And Susan, without question, is the love of my life. But I will always love Joni. How could you not? She's not only beautiful, but she's a genius. And I love beautiful, smart women.
Are you in touch with her even today?
Well, Joni lives at the other end of the day than I do. I'm a father and a grandfather, and I have family, and I get up around 8 in the morning, 9 in the morning, and I get on with my day. Joni can't wait for everybody to go to sleep so she can start painting and writing. And so she lives at a different time of the day than I do. But yes, she last talked to me a couple of months ago when we were doing this benefit with Peter Gabriel in New York. And yeah, I'm still in touch with Joan. It's a very touchy relationship. She knows I love her dearly. She speaks very highly of me, and she doesn't speak highly of most of the men in her life, but she speaks highly of me because the time, you know, the couple of years that we were together were magic. People said that, you know, you and Joni would walk into the room and it would light up. And we were totally in love, and almost like teenagers also. Not that we were, but it was that kind of feeling, and there was that amount of passion. I will always love Joni. How could you not?
Graham Nash is our guest. His new book is an autobiography. It's titled Wild Tales. You know, hanging with Joni Mitchell, Graham, hanging with David Crosby and Stephen Stills changed the way that you looked at music and, I guess, the potential with what you could do with it eventually. How did hanging with them change the way you looked at all that?
That was one of the great fun things about first meeting David and Stephen was their songs. They were about something. They had a raison d'être. They had a reason for living, the songs themselves. I was brought up in a slightly different format. You know, we could write, the Hollies could write, you know, 2.5 minute songs to be played right before the news brilliantly. I mean, by the time I'd left, I think we had like, you know, 16 or 17 top 10 hits, you know. So we were very successful at that. But with all due respect to, you know, to songs like Bus Stop and Carrie Anne and On a Carousel, etc., they're decent songs, but they're shallow is not the right word, but they're not profound songs. Mm-hmm. They're fun songs to listen to and to sing to, no doubt about it. When I came to America to be with David and Stephen, and Neil and Joni, I began to realize that songs had to touch people's heart and souls, that, you know, they had to be more than just Moon, June, Screw Me in the Back of the Car kind of songs.
Mm-hmm.
And they definitely changed the way that I approached music. I know that that every song has to have a reason to exist. It has to teach you something, because I don't write for David and Stephen. I don't write for Crosby, Stills and Nash, or Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young, and neither do the other guys. We write for ourselves. We have to get stuff out of our soul and off our chests, and the way we do it is by music. And so that sound that we created the first time we sang together,
mm-hmm.
plus who David and Stephen and Neil were, plus their songs and the you know, how profound many of them were. I was in love with everything when I first came to America. This was heaven for me.
You know, when you think about the Beatles and Hendrix and Joni Mitchell and Cass Elliot and Mick Jagger and all these legends that you have rubbed shoulders with, you know, is there a tie that binds all these people together, all these great musicians together, Graham?
Yes. And the things that keeps us going is the passion for, you got to understand, you were supposed to do what your dad did. You're supposed to do mm-hmm. what your grandfather did. And if it was good enough for him to go down the mines or work in the mill, then it's good enough for you, lad, and get on with it. Fortunately, my mother and father never allowed me to fall for that gold watch theory where you work for somebody for, you know, 70 years of your life and then you get a gold watch and they replace you with somebody younger, stronger, and cheaper. They never let me fall for that. So there's a certain passion about getting out of that way of living, plus the passion of coming into sexuality when you're a teenager, plus the idea that you can make money with music, all came together. And I think that all those people that you just mentioned had exactly the same way of growing up.
Mm-hmm.
We were lucky to get out of Manchester. We were lucky to get out of wherever we lived in London. We were lucky to escape having to do what your dad did. We were musicians, and we could affect the world and get paid for it. I'm a very lucky man, Steve.
Boy, no kidding. You know, and that influence of Joni Mitchell and David Crosby and Stephen Stills, it was those relationships that began to form that eventually caused you to fall away from the Hollies because you found a need to go deeper, if I remember the book correctly, Graham.
Not only to go deeper, but I here's what happened. Here's one of the things that happened. The couple of reasons why I had to leave the Hollies were that they were hesitant about recording songs that I had written. I remember one in particular, which I wrote in Split in Yugoslavia in the late 60s, called King Midas in Reverse.
Yeah.
And we made a great record of it, but it only got into the top 30 and not the top 5, which was like that we'd been used to all those years. And so they started to not want to record my song. I wrote a song called The Sleep Song where I say, I'll take off my clothes and I'll lie by your side. And they thought that was horrific. And we can't bloody sing that. I mean, that's almost pornography there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they wanted to do an album of Bob Dylan songs in a kind of a Las Vegas kind of style. And that rubbed me the wrong way. So they did to me what you must never do to a musician, and that's have him doubt himself or herself.
Mm-hmm.
When you start to doubt yourself, you become somewhat paralyzed. But it was Crosby that saved my life, because he said, you know, those songs, you know, that Teach Your Children and that Lady of the Island, those are really good songs. Come on, they're crazy, not you. So he took away my self doubt, and I'll be ever grateful to David for doing that. So when I'd heard me and David and Stephen sing together, plus not wanting to do the Dylan album, plus them not wanting to record my songs, it was obvious to me that I had to leave. Hmm. Now then, it caused me great consternation, because Alan Clark had been my friend since I was 6 years old. I mean, we started together. We sang the Everly Brothers stuff. We became two teenagers with guitars. We formed the Hollies, you know. We were successful. And one of the pains in my life was having to leave Alan Clark behind. But I'd heard that sound. And as a musician, that's what I wanted. My soul craved that kind of harmonic structure and those songs that we were writing.
Did you and Alan Clark, again, you guys used to sing the Lord's Prayer together in grade school. Did you ever get back on good terms?
Absolutely. David and I played the Royal Albert Hall in London several years ago, and we were actually opening the show with 8 Miles High, which was a very famous song by the Birds, of course.
Yeah.
And we'd never done a Holly song, so I started to we worked up a Bus Stop, and we were doing it in our set. So when we got to the Albert Hall, I went to David and I said, "You trust me, right, Dave?" He goes, "Of course I trust you. Why?" I said, "I want to bring Alan Clark out to sing Bus Stop with us tonight."
Wow.
And so at the Royal Albert Hall in London, with the Crosby Nash Show, Alan came out and sang Bus Stop. And after I introduced him, the audience went absolutely crazy because he's very famous in England, of course. And that went a long way to healing the hurt that he must have felt when I left.
Let's listen to Bus Stop from the Hollies.
She's there, I say, reshare my umbrella. Bus stop, bus go, she stays, love grows under my umbrella. All that summer we enjoyed it, wind and rain and shine. That umbrella we employed it, by August she was mine. She would show me what she bought. All the people stared as if we were both quite insane. Someday my name and hers are going to be the same.
You know, I've never thought about this before, Graham, but Buddy Holly had a huge influence on the name of the Hollies. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do. Buddy was one of us.
Yeah.
He didn't look like Elvis. He didn't shake his head. He wasn't sexy. He was one of us. He had glasses. He looked like a nerd. But he was a brilliant, brilliant songwriter. What a lot of people don't realize is that he only recorded for about 20 months before he was killed in 1959 with the Big Bopper and Ritchie Valens
in
that plane crash in Clear Lake, Iowa. He was one of us. We could relate instantly, not only to him, but to his music. And I think that if you'd ever talked to Paul, because, sadly John and George are gone, he would be the first to admit that Buddy Holly was of a huge influence on the Beatles. And, when the Hollies first started, our very first show at the Oasis, which was a club in Manchester, the compere looked at us and he said, "I'm about to introduce you. What are you called?" And we hadn't really thought about it. We had a drummer, Don Rathbone, who was a son of a man that owned a mortuary, and he had a van, and he was only a decent, he was only a half decent drummer, but he had a van, so he was in the band, So Don says, "How about the Deadbeats?" And we went, "Nah, that doesn't kind of sound like us." And then we said, "Well, what about the Hollies?" Because it was December of 1962 when we did our very first professional show.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was Buddy Holly and the Crickets, and some have said that the Beatles named themselves the Beatles because Buddy Holly and the Crickets, well, what's like a cricket? A beetle. Is that right?
Absolutely true. And the Birds also.
Oh, that's amazing.
Now, they deliberately misspelled it as B-Y-R-D-S, but they also did the same thing. Amazing how this chain moves forward into the future, isn't it?
It's incredible. And Graham, before you go, I got to ask you about Neil Young, because you call him a weird cat. And you tell a story in this book that just is drop-dead hilarious about previewing Neil Young's Harvest album for you. Where did he take you to do that?
Well, I was at Neil's ranch one day, and he says, "Hey, Willie, you want to hear my new record, Harvest?" I said, "Yeah, sure, man. Let's go into the studio and hear it," because he has a fabulous studio. "Oh, no, this is Neil. Get into the rowboat, Willie." "What? Come on, we'll row out into the..." He has a beautiful lake on his property. "We'll go out into the middle of the lake."
And he calls Willie because of your middle name, right? Yeah.
Yeah, my friends call me Willie. I know you know, how old they are by what they call me. So I'm rowing out into the middle of a lake with Neil, and I'm thinking, well, maybe he's got a cassette player he wants me to listen to with headphones or something, you know. No, remember, this is Neil. He had his entire house as one speaker and his entire barn as the other speaker. And he blasted Harvest out louder than hell to us in the middle of this lake in a rowboat. After the album was done, we kind of rowed back. And Elliot Mazur, who produced Harvest, is a dear friend, came down to the shoreline and said to him, how was it, Neil? And I swear to God, Neil looked at him and he shouted, more barn!
That's just a great story.
It's a true story.
I just can't get over it. I mean, Stills and Young had a fierce rivalry. You and Stills sometimes feuded. How did that whole thing work?
I have no idea, Stephen. I don't have a clue.
Yeah.
It's not supposed to work. I'm from England. You know, Neil's from Canada. You know, Stephen spent a lot of his time in South America, in Costa Rica, and David's from California. It's not supposed to work. We're completely different people. But somehow, by God's grace, it does work. And it continues to work to this day. As I said, you know, this box set of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young from 1974, which comes out in July, I think will stun people with how good a band we are. Mm. Because not only were we good musicians, and still are, of course, but we had the songs, and still do.
You say at the end of this book that walking out on stage is still a rush. It still feels like the very first time. That just floored
yes.
me.
But it's true. I mean, you know, we've been very fortunate. We've made a lot of money in this music life that we've led. I don't have to do this at all. I could be, you know, in my home in Hawaii with my wife and my children and my grandchildren. And my son, Will, you know, my second born son, him and his wife are expecting twins in July.
Oh, congratulations.
So,
yeah.
So I could spend my time at home. I can afford not to go out and play another note if I want, if I choose to. But I'm a musician. I can't wait to play you the new song. I can't wait for to being on the edge of sleep and having what Crosby refers to as the elves taking over the workshop, which is where a lot of writing goes on. When everyone's asleep and people's brains are settling down for the night, that's when I do most of my thinking. I've never been a good sleeper at all in my life. I you know, if I get 3 or 4 hours a night, I'm lucky because I'm constantly thinking about what to do and what to write and how to create. This is an incredible life, Stephen, and I'm 72 years old, as you mentioned earlier. So how, in all reality, how long can this go on? But I'm going to be writing songs and making music until they put me in my grave.
Graham Nash is the author of Wild Tales, his new autobiography. He gives the keynote address today at the 26th Annual Folk Alliance Conference and Winter Music Camp down at Crown Center. Graham, it's been such a pleasure to have you. I enjoy talking to you so much. What a great thrill it was for me.
Thank you very much, Steve, and say hello to everybody. I love NPR.
I'll light the fire. You place the flowers in the vase that you bought today. Staring at the fire for hours and hours while I listen to you play your love songs all night long. Oh,
so hard. Now everything is easy 'cause of you. Today.